To a large extent, our paradigms of others determine our leadership philosophy and style. Stephen next presents four leadership paradigms or assumptions and shows how they influence our actions as leaders.
Let me describe a metaphor of each of these four needs. It's a simple word, a symbol. Physical, stomach. Okay. Emotional, social, what would that be? Heart. Psychological,
mind.
Spiritual,
soul.
Soul or spirit, whatever you want to call it. Those are metaphors, see? Now, what's a paradigm? It's a map of the territory. If you had an inaccurate map of this building, you couldn't find this room, regardless of how diligent you were or how positive your attitude was. You'd be lost twice as fast, and you would laugh about being lost because you're thinking so positively you don't care about it. See, you have an inaccurate map. Okay, now what we're doing is going way back to studying our nature to try to understand. We've come to recognize these needs. This is very, very validated in so many scientific studies as well. And there are others, but I suggest they're offshoots of these four, particularly that psychological need. So many ramifications of that. Identifying talent, developing talent, utilizing talent, recognizing talent. And we've got the metaphors. The body, the heart, the mind, and the spirit or the soul. All right, now, you're a manager. You're a parent. Now think of what would be the approach to manage, to parent, to lead people, families, organizations. Now think. Notice we studied human motivation before we studied management theory. You study human motivation before you study communications theory. If you study communication and management theory first, what's going to happen?
You don't really understand people. Yeah. Techniques.
You don't deal with nature. You start with values. You start with artificiality. You start with abstraction. Always start with the most fundamental. What is our nature? Now, by the way, these are not just needs. That's too small of a term. These are capacities. These are talents. These are energies. These are intelligences, not just needs. So if you have, say, the first two needs or capacities met, but the next two are not being met, what will you do? What will you do with your mind and with your sense of purpose?
Stagnate.
You could stagnate. That's right.
Find it elsewhere.
Or you could seek for it elsewhere. You know, you could inwardly die and just kind of withdraw and get nurtured by creature comforts to maybe anesthetize the boredom and the yuckiness of every day, see? You could. Or you could see the job purely as a means to an end and then find your real satisfactions with your family, with your community, your church, your friends, and with projects out there, see? That gives you your intrinsic satisfactions to these needs. All right, now we're trying to look at the question. How do we manage? Start with your motivational paradigm. Okay, now think. If you saw people as a stomach, that's the symbol for the economic need, it's called the economic man assumption, what would be your management philosophy? Assume that's all you had in your paradigm.
Get off your money.
That's right. Okay, if you do this,
I'll
give you this. If you don't do it, you don't get it. If you are willing to do this, we'll hire you and pay you. And you can use that to survive. The carrot in front, the stick behind. Does it work? It works short term, temporarily, but let's say that you're in a long-term survival mode. Does it work?
Very inefficient.
I think. You're barely surviving.
If you're able to continue to provide,
you continue to do that, see? And they'd want to work longer hours so they can survive a little more. And they might give their best efforts and their best energies.
Once the need is met, it's over.
That's right. See, if you didn't have air, you know, what would happen to your interest? Now that you have air, does air motivate you?
No.
And your point was?
When you have a need that's fulfilled, it's no longer a motivation.
It's no longer a motivator. It's not an activator. See? It's only the unmet needs that motivate. One of the great theorists, Abraham Maslow, developed this need hierarchy, which is kind of embodied in this expression here. But you know what happened to him? He renunciated it, essentially. Not renunciated all of it, it's just that he said it isn't complete enough. And he put the self-actualization need at what I would call the psychological level, and the self-transcendent need at the kind of spiritual level. It wasn't your fulfillment and self-actualization that was the highest need. It was helping others to not only fulfill themselves, but to transcend themselves, so that you create a kind of immortality in people's projects and meanings. It's very interesting. Those who are interested ought to read the little book brought out after his death called Toward the Higher Reaches of Human Nature, where he describes that. He also concluded that the need hierarchy was too need-driven, a little too deterministic, that we really have more internal power to choose. For instance, take a terrorist. What motivates the terrorist, usually?
Cause.
Cause. Which you'd put up here as
spiritual.
Meaning. Mm-hmm. And are they willing to even become martyrs for the cause?
Yes.
And how do they use their minds? Create ways to make that cause happen, see? So they're very creative. What about the social? What happens? What satisfies them?
Surrounded by people of the same cause.
Surrounded by people. They are so close-knit, so bonded by that cause. They are so loyal to each other, and essentially eclipse the physical need, the economic need. We have the power. We have a lot more freedom inside these needs than a lot of people have supposed. Okay, but let's go on. We're going back now in our analysis. If you use the carrot and the stick, what could we call that approach to management?
Authoritarian,
because the person who hires, who wields the carrot and stick, who says this is what I want you to do, directs and controls everything. Now, science teaches you a great deal about efficiency and technologies and things. And if you can bring the study of efficiency and combine it together with authoritarian control, you have the dominant management style, management paradigm, you could say, even, in the world from the beginning. And probably the second and third world is still as the dominant one. Why? Where are people?
Survival.
Huh? Surviving. See what I mean? So they'll use all their needs to survive. And even in affluent, industrialized, civilized nations of the first world, I suggest that is also a very strong, pragmatic paradigm. The more affluent they are, and the more democratic the society it is, and the more safety nets there are to people, and the more you have an educated people, now what's happening? It starts tapping into other kinds of needs and capacities.
Arnold Toynbee once said, "You can summarize all of history in a simple little formula, challenge-response. When the response is equal to the challenge, you have success. As soon as the challenge changes and you apply the old response, it equals failure." In other words, nothing fails like success. I think what's happened is that the management paradigms have been responses to the challenges that have been existing in the world. The authoritarian paradigm has dominated most of the world from the beginning. And it works. Why? Because people are struggling for survival. And so if you wield the carrot and the stick, they'll respond to it. but that's only one part of their nature. You can buy a person's hand, but not their heart. You can buy their back, but not their mind. Those have to be volunteered. That's why it's important to treat your people as volunteers, just like you treat customers as volunteers. Science married the authoritarian paradigm, which basically came out of the Middle Ages, where the basic models were feudalistic systems, the farms, and also the church and the military. Science married it around 1890. The Industrial Revolution caused the authoritarian scientific paradigm to become the most powerful one till about 1930. In 1930, another paradigm moved in. You could call it the human relations paradigm, or if you want to, the benevolent authoritarian paradigm. People are more than just bodies, they have hearts. How we treat them is very important. And society demands that people be treated with kindness and dignity and respect. Now, many people don't do that. Nevertheless, that became the paradigm that is taught and was strong at the time. Around 1960, the emergence of a more powerful paradigm started to occur. We could call it the human resource paradigm. Not only how people are treated, but how they are developed and how they are used. The international marketplace, a world economy, started to develop in a serious way. All of the advantages which gave the United States unquestioned economic superiority began to erode away to where there are almost none of those left. Many organizations started to work harder and to work more cooperatively. And the human resources paradigm started to tap into their thought processes and into their deeper commitments. And they started to produce quality and consistency and reliability in ways that had never been achieved before. The human resource paradigm built on top of the human relations paradigm and saw people not just as a stomach and as a heart, but as a mind. The principle-centered leadership paradigm sees people in a whole sense, body, heart, mind, and spirit. What is it that gives those people meaning? What is it that gives them a sense their lives matter? That becomes very important. In the authoritarian paradigm, you might ask how a person's pay situation is. In the human relations paradigm, you might ask how they are, how their family is, how they enjoyed their vacation, or whatever. In the human resource paradigm, you'd ask them their opinion. In the principle-centered leadership paradigm, you'd ask all those questions and then add, what's truly important to you? What gives your life meaning? It's the paradigm that breaks with the other three in kind, not just degree. Because people are intrinsically valuable. They are not just assets or resources. They have their own worth independent of the organization. And they have the power to make their own choices. And out of those choices, collectively, to create this third domain where the law of the unenforceable operate. You see, this new paradigm is holistic. It deals with it all. It's also an ecological paradigm. And a developmental paradigm, starting inside out. And it's based upon people as programmers, everything else being a program. Well, you might ask, is this too idealistic? That's a good question. I'm asked that frequently. My response is that natural laws operate regardless. That person may be really asking, can I change? Can people change? If they're not living in harmony with natural laws now, can they change? We are not animals. We have the power of choice. We are response-able people. We are responsible people. We can change. Gandhi said, 7 things will destroy us, and we have the power to choose. That's what's unique, which one we want to take. These were the 7 he mentioned. Wealth without work. By the way, as you listen to these 7, think of the law of the farm and the law of the school. Wealth without work. Pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, politics without principle, science without humanity, religion without sacrifice. See, this material focuses upon effectiveness, not upon ineffectiveness. Of course these things are workable. Now you may ask, where's the evidence? Do you have any empirical scientific evidence? My response is, fish discover water last. You study any truly effective person or any truly effective organization. You study a society that works, and you'll find at bottom it is based upon principles. I would challenge anyone to find otherwise. Now, I'm not talking about a short-term success. I'm not talking about a windfall gain. I'm not talking about the appearances of success. I'm talking about true success, true effectiveness that is balanced, that is integrated, and that is long-term as well as short-term, and that respects the interests of all stakeholders. I would challenge anyone to find any society, any institution, any family or person that has that kind of success that is not fundamentally centered on principles. Fish discover water last. The evidence is overwhelming. It's everywhere. You see, in the last analysis, the concept of principle-centered leadership embodies and expresses the Eastern philosophy, which I've always loved. Give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. So with your kids, with your employees, instead of giving practices to people, teach them principles. If they're very, very new and insecure, and you give them a practice, teach the principle upon which that practice is based, so that as they mature and the situation changes, they can develop another practice that is in harmony with or consistent with that principle. We want to help people be empowered to become independent of us, so that they then can choose this third domain, to be interdependent, to be part of this magnificent culture, part of the immune system. This takes in all of us these three qualities, in my opinion, above almost everything else, that we have vision, that we have great courage, and that we have great compassion. I should say one more quality, a fourth, that we have great integrity, because that's the source of courage balanced with compassion. The four basic needs of all people: to live, to love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. These are the needs that need to be expressed in people's jobs and in every person's organization. To live means just to survive economically, to meet the needs of you and your loved ones and those in your stewardship. To love is the quality of our culture, our relationship. To learn is to keep growing, to developing. To leave a legacy means to matter, to make a difference.
Einstein said, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." Again, the significant problems, see, the major ones, the ones with deep tentacles and roots, ones that affect all kinds of other things, deep, persisting, chronic problems, low quality, low trust. See, a whole culture that is at war within itself. Those are significant problems. Cannot be solved at the same level of thinking. What's he talking about? Paradigm. See? It isn't working harder with the old way of thinking. It is the new way of thinking. Now, we're looking at this way of thinking that embodies all four levels, so that all four basic needs and capacities are activated. Now, a lot of people always say we need a new management approach. What is that going to be? What's the answer to the how? Why not one that uses these four principles? Because they deal with the four basic needs. That's principle-centered leadership, which I suggest is timely now. This is a day that that idea has its time. This is its day, see, for all the reasons we have talked about. Now, at bottom, we concluded that if you were to, in a very cumulative sense, characterize the paradigms, one would be a thing paradigm, the other one would be a people paradigm. A thing paradigm means that you're a thing, you can be moved, like this chair. I can move this chair, and you manipulate your pen and your paper. Whatever we have, things, my watch, see, I can control this. I can change it, I can take it off. I can be efficient with this. That's the value of the thing paradigm. The first three, including the human resource, tend to see people as a thing. That's why I mention that the difference between the first three and the fourth is the difference in kind, where the difference between the first three is a difference in degree. Let me just illustrate. In fact, talk about my son. My boy was into this efficiency kick, see? He has his planner out there and has everything organized, 15-minute segments, and he's going to do this from this time, this to this time, take this class. Class ends at 1:45, then he's going to 10 to 10, then at 10 o'clock, he goes and picks up some books, and then he goes over here and he gets into a phone booth so that he can drop Margaret. That's from about 10:05 to 10:20. And then 10:20 to 10:30, he has to go to the bookstore to pick up some instruments, and then he prepares for a test at 11 o'clock. See? Have you ever studied your life that way or planned your life that way? You know, you carefully think through when. Maybe not that tight, but maybe you have. Well, one of the items was to drop Margaret. And Margaret is not a thing. She's a person. And my son, in his kind of private ruminations, had concluded that, there wasn't any mileage in this relationship anymore, and be best, for the sake of both of them, that it come to an end. And he didn't want to do it face-to-face, so he delegated it to a phone, because face-to-face can be kind of tight. What if she cried, you know? He didn't want to get all that emotional scene going on, so calls her up on the phone. Hi, Margaret. How you doing? Yeah, how are things going? How's your test week? I can't believe it. See, I've got a plan to 2, 3, maybe 4 at the most minutes for kind of socializing, exchange a few pleasantries, you know, before I deliver the message, because you got to kind of prepare them, and then maybe deliver the message, and then that's difficult for 3 or 4 minutes, then kind of massage the heart and make him feel good at the end. I mean, that's a real, it's going to take a lot of effort. Maybe 10 minutes, but I'll give it 15 just in case. Well, Margaret, what's happening? Oh, really? Yeah, I had a test too. It had nothing to do with the material that was covered at all. I just can't believe it, you know. Really? No. Oh, she's going on. I can't believe this. Oh, she's got 3 minutes. Oh, this story, we're not even beginning to approximate the end. Oh, yeah. Oh, you ever been just, huh? Margaret, excuse me. Margaret, sorry to interrupt. I would like to hear about that. I just wondered if I could talk to you for a moment about something a little more serious. I've been doing a lot of thinking and about both of us and our relationship, and finally concluded that maybe the best thing for us both is just to kind of be good friends. You know what I mean, Margaret? Margaret? Margaret, are you there? He had to go and spend time with her and with her mother. I mean, it was really discombobulating to his schedule. I mean, just threw so many things. Totally out of kilter.